Hi fellow brain pickers, and welcome to episode 63 of Can I Pick Your Brain? Today I am truly honored to be picking the legendary brain of marketing genius Jay Abraham. He has been named one of the top 5 executive coaches in the country by Forbes. Stephen Covey has named him one of the greatest business and marketing minds he ever met. Jay has mentored and coached some of the greatest of our time, including Tony Robbins, Brian Tracy, Ramit Sethi, and Damon John from Shark Tank, among many others. He's made billions of dollars for others and has personally worked with over 10,000 clients in more than 400 industries. In a world filled with hot-aired, self-proclaiming gurus, I bring to you the real deal. The man who doesn't just talk the talk, but walks the walk and helps others do the same. Jay, welcome to the show, and thanks for letting me pick your brain.
Well, first of all, I'm honored, Daniel. And secondly, thank goodness we're not on video because I'm purple red with embarrassment. But that was very gracious. Thank you.
I'm sure you've had many, many intros like that, right, in the past.
Well,
you know, you're probably used to it by now.
Very gracious. Now, let's see if I can live up to your standards. That's the challenge.
Well, I just want to say to the audience listening, for those of you that know Jay, I've read Jay's book, and I've been a big fan of his. So for me, it was like a big deal to get him on the show. He's an extremely busy and very accomplished individual. And I just did like a 10-minute just pre-show kind of a video with him. And I have to say, I'm absolutely amazed at how humble you are, Jay. You really genuinely want to help people. It's not just about the money for you. And it's such a huge lesson. And you know what I want to do with this show is, I'm sure you get asked the same questions over and over again, and I thought I would make this a little bit more interesting. You ready to roll, Jay?
As I told you in the pre-discussion, I love surprises. I have no idea what you're going to ask, but I suspect they'll be very worthy questions that will be very enlightening for your listeners. So go for it.
All right, here we go. So first of all, I want you to share something that you've never shared before.
Okay, how about this?
Okay.
I think I may have shared it very, very, very. This is going back in my origin, because I started out with no education and got married at 18 and had 2 kids at the age of 20 and the needs of somebody 40. And we lived with my mother and father. And the first, this is interesting. When I got married, we got married in a courthouse, and on the way home, we were involved in a 3-car collision. And the tow truck brought the remnants of the car and my new wife to my parents for our honeymoon.
Oh, my goodness.
And I saved up. We had one car that was a beat up one that I bought for my wife, and I took 3 buses to go to my first job. And the first night we moved into our new apartment, I got fired. I don't think I've shared that with a lot of people. And I took the last buses home because I was so embarrassed and didn't get home till about midnight. And I was heartbroken, but it was a very defining experience in my life. So there's a piece of not success-based, but challenging your tensile strength-based. It was memorable. Let's put it that way.
I mean, what did you take from that, though? What did you said it was very memorable, and it's there's a reason why you brought it up. Of all the things you could have brought, and you've got tons and tons of experience. Why that? Why particularly that story?
Because it was a redefining moment. A couple of other incidents similar at the same time when I was struggling for direction, purpose, identity. But I realized at first I was almost comatose, depressed, self-pitying, wallowing in a mental miasma of feeling victim. And then I realized the world doesn't care. The world doesn't care, and I don't mean this disrespectful. Mm-hmm. They don't care if you're down and you dust yourself off and you don't just jump back in the ring, but you knock out the opponent and you go higher and higher. The world doesn't care if you wish to be a victim and just self self-destruct, and with the liberating realization that there's, you know, yesterday is irrelevant. I mean, as long as you maintain your integrity and your ethos and you don't sell that out, it was a very, it was liberating, and it sort of was the first fuel cell of propellant to my desire and my actual, not just desire, because that's aspirational, my focus on higher, broader, wider, more meaningful achievement. So it was a very defining sort of an event, if that makes sense. I don't know if I explained it too complexly.
No, it makes 100% sense. Let me ask you this. If you just found out now that you only have a week left to live, sorry about the morbid question here, but
well, that's okay.
What would you spend your time doing?
Well, probably, because in all honesty, there's the adage in my field that, you know, we're all trying to learn what we're teaching. I've been fanatically obsessed with the betterment of value creation oriented entrepreneurs all my life. Mm-hmm. And it's been to some degree at the detriment of my family. I'm very proud of my achievements. I'm proud of the impact, but I have seven children from three marriages, and they love me, but I've been more sometimes, my mistress has been entrepreneurship, and I would probably basically spend as much time with them as I could. And then I would make sure that, not for legacy, but for contribution, as much of my body of work was re-entrusted to people who could freely distribute it in a meaningful way to current and future entrepreneurs, so that I knew that it wouldn't, not because I'm that important, but I think that a lot of what I have both discovered, synthesized, is profoundly important, particularly the preeminent stuff, and it would be shameful if it died because no one perpetuated it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And
based, I don't know if that answers, if it sounds selfish, but it's not meant to be.
Hey, listen, Jay, as long as you're being truthful and real, then that doesn't really matter what anybody thinks of what you say, right?
That's true. Right? We only have to live with ourselves ultimately and die.
Yeah, and I recently heard an amazing quote. What you think of me has nothing to do with me.
It's very profound. Very profound. I like that. When we're done, repeat it, because I want to be in the moment, not write things down. But I would like to share that with a lot of people. I think it's elegantly simple but profound. Thank you.
But based on your answer, like, why do you do what you do? Based on what you just said, if you had a week left, you would spend it with your family. Why do you do what you do?
Well, this is it's a great question. I think I can give you an interesting answer, because I've spent deep reflective time trying to understand my own motivations. I don't think most people really understand themselves deeply enough, and I'm not saying I do, but I tried to chronicle why, how, and what drove me in the beginning and sustained it. And it never was money, although I needed to make a livelihood. It was an attraction to entrepreneurs who vividly and passionately were either or both trying to add greater contribution value to an industry, a product, or service category than their competitors, or saw a void that they felt needed to be filled, but that they were motivated first and foremost on a purpose based, not on a avaricious based. And I was obsessively, let's call it, positively contaminated by their passion, their purpose, their sense of possibility, and it was not ever money motivated. And then as I got older and got exposed to so many higher performing ways to market, sell, be strategic instead of tactical, compete, reach markets, add value, I would see people who were underperforming and were restricting, limiting, constraining their ability to contribute, to reach, to serve more people. And I realized that they were dedicating their entire life and accepting a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, not just of the economic results, but of the meaningful contribution if they were really value creators, and also the wealth they could create and the impact they could have. And that was sort of a composite driver, and it's probably evolved and gotten, you know, morphed and become more of a kaleidoscopic, a sort of amalgam of drivers today. But I think if I go back, that would be it. I don't know. Again, please stop me if I'm being too confusing.
You know, people always ask, what's the definition of an entrepreneur? You know, how would you define an entrepreneur?
Well, I would borrow Peter Drucker's, because I love it and I use it repetitively in discussion. He said there are two types of business people, proprietors and entrepreneurs. And his analogy was a deli, but you can elevate it to the highest pinnacle of business. He said the average deli owner buys a deli, starts a deli, opens a deli in an area where there's already, you know, food service businesses, and he or she is really doing nothing more than trying to divert oxygen and commerce from the area. And if you go into their deli, it's going to be clean, and they're going to have, you know, hopefully fresh, you know, meats and cheeses and breads, and it'll be the polite, and hopefully the tables will be clean and the people have nice uniforms, but it'll be non-descriptive, non-eventful, non-memorable, and certainly non-differentiated. He said a true entrepreneur starts out with the desire to create a greater outcome, a greater experience, a greater impact positively and not selflessly, but meaningfully to the, you know, to the client, to the customer. We use the word client, but that's a different discussion. And that the true entrepreneur is driven by creating greater experience, value, advantage, whatever, it depends on what business you're in, whether you're providing mm-hmm. protection, advantage, benefit, excitement, whatever it is. But he or she starts and they think about it from the total perspective of the experience of the other side. Mm-hmm. What's it going to be like when they embrace the front? What's it going to be like? The smells, it, you know, what's it going to be like when they look at the counter? What are the signage? What are the expressions, the connections that the staff will have? What are the various nuances that will make it a most wondrous and meaningful experience and differentiate them in not just from monetary terms, because money is a reward for adding value. Should be. If you're making money just because you're opportunistic, it's not going to be long lived. But if you're adding value continuously and not static about it, you'll be rewarded. But that's what I think an entrepreneur is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, do you know what I think an entrepreneur is?
Please.
Somebody who can't do anything else. Like, that's it. Like, to me, it's an entrepreneur is someone who cannot work for anybody else. Simple. Now, I worked in my father's grocery store because I needed to pay the bills. And I'm telling you, I literally woke up depressed every single day.
Well, let me add to it very interestingly. If you exempt technologists, which is a different kind of an entrepreneur often, and you look at about every other one, if you go back and regressively analyze their life, most of them were still, they were enterprising when they were young. They either bought and sold pop bottles or rebuilt bicycles or had three paper routes or, you know, sold lemonade. And it was almost in their DNA, and I do agree with you, an entrepreneur is someone that it's not defiant, but it's impossible for them to work for anyone else, not because they resent them, but because they have a different path and they have a different vision and they are fanatically independent and they're very colorful. The mm-hmm. wonderful thing about entrepreneurs, they're every size, kind, dimension, and they're some of the most really interesting and not just fascinating, but but amazing people on anybody who's got the ability to manifest a vision and successfully grow it in service. Again, I keep hitting on the service to others, but let's delete that. Just to manifest a vision and grow it, monetize it at any size. It doesn't matter, right, if you're local, regional, national, international, intergalactic.
Yeah.
And it's pretty profound. It's pretty profound.
Here's the thing, Jay.
I'm right on an airport runway, and we have a big helicopter manufacturing company here that's always testing their helicopters. So if you hear chop, 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 it's
the helicopter flying off
outside my window.
Very cool. I want you to share this story because it's such a great story. There was a company called Icy Hot. It was a product called Icy Hot. So I guess for those listening that don't know what Icy Hot is, can you explain what it is and how you got involved in and how what you did with them? Because I find it fascinating.
Yeah, sure. It's got a lot of very interesting analogies and metaphoric implications. And I do say today it must be helicopter testing days because a beautiful day where I am. So this is going to go back in time. Today, Icy Hot is pretty well known in the States. It's a very prominent consumer brand that's advertised everywhere and in the stores. But 30 some years ago, I was with a company, and the company specialized in buying old line mail order patent medicines that were almost dead, and they revitalized them. And one of the products they bought was an old line company called J.W. Gibson that sold a product called Icy Hot. We were going to try to figure out what to do with it, but we did a little analysis on the buyers, and what we found is even though they hadn't promoted very aggressively for years, and this goes to a very powerful concept most people don't understand, we looked at what we will call lifetime value, marginal net worth, and we were looking at these factors 30 years before anyone was really bantering the language around. And we found that every time we got about 10 new buyers, 8 of them would sustain literally forever because there was no cure for arthritis, bursitis, rheumatism, and the product was wonderful on temporary relief. And not only that, but out of the 8, about 4 would buy at least one other product multiple times a year. And out of those 4, at least 1.5 would buy, and I might be off on my point, maybe it's 2, bulk to give away to their senior age friends. And the aggregate value every time we got 10 first time buyers was about 100 times, just to be very, very simple, what it was worth. And we, at the time, this is long ago, our out of the door cost was 55 cents to make it, put it in a package, send it to somebody. Geez, I'm so sorry. I've never had this many helicopters out.
It's okay. I can't even hear it.
Okay. So to send it out, and we sold it for $3 by mail. And this is, you know, mid 70s. And so we had a profit margin of $2.45. We didn't have any marketing budget. And my charge, my purpose, my job, totally on performance, was to go to as many radio stations, television stations, publications as I could and persuade them to run ads whenever they had unsold time, space for our product, selling it for $3 and giving them, we didn't give them 100%, we gave them 115%. We let them keep all the money and we actually sent them an extra 45 cents and we analyzed the whole business of risk reversal. What was the risk to a media of doing that? Well, the first risk was the product wouldn't perform. But if we weren't making a penny, obviously it was inherent on us to make the product not only perform, but to get it into people's hands right away so they would reorder. Number two, stations, media were worried people wouldn't get the product. So we would send 2 or 3 dozen bottles to the media to have on hand, even if the product was en route, so that we would always be the good guy. Third, they worried they wouldn't get paid, and we just let them keep the money and just rush us the buyer name so we could fulfill. So in a very quick, the story gets even more interesting. I was very able, through a lot of different experimentation, to find very compelling, persuasive ways to get a lot of media. We ended up with about 1,000 radio stations, television stations, magazines, product shippers that had products that were parallel universes to our buyer profile, to work with us on a purely performance basis. We ended up at about a year with 500,000 repeat buyers.
Wow.
And a very significant, but it gets better. We got $27 million at that time, which would probably be like $200 million today of free advertising. And we accidentally forced retail distribution, meaning everybody started going to their pharmacies, their groceries, asking for it. And they started contacting us. And we accidentally became a consumer product. It was bought by a company that was a pharmaceutical company in Chicago called G.D. Searle, which was subsequently acquired by somebody else for tens of millions of dollars. But here's the hilarity, if anybody understands direct marketing. They didn't even want the buyer list. They just gave us a non-compete in arthritis. So we got to keep 500,000 consistent quality buyers of the product. They didn't even want the company. They just wanted the product. We got to keep the brand name associated with it. We got to keep all the 1,000 distribution channels. That's a pretty interesting story.
That's incredible. But let me ask you this. What does it take for you to come up with an idea like that? Meaning, why is it, what separates you from everybody else? Like, why would someone pay?
There is an answer, and it's a hard won answer, and it's a clinically based, not an arrogantly based.
Okay.
What defined me, and this is probably a very meaningful piece of understanding me, because I had no education and because I had an outrageously oversized obligation to kids and young, I had nobody that would give me a job that would pay me anything. So I only worked with entrepreneurs who gave me pretty much performance-based activities. And I jumped because I was very, very curious, and perhaps at the time I was there's a word, I was more of I can't think of the word right now, but it means that I was transitory. And I'd go from one industry, not job, but industry, to another. After about 10, Daniel, I made a startling, stunning, and life-altering realization, and that was that people in one industry had no clue how people in another sold, marketed, distributed, accessed, competed, generated ancillary income. And I was able to start borrowing success approaches that were very commonplace in one industry, combine them, integrate them into hybrids, and then apply them to industries that never experienced them. And you can't see my hand, but it's rising past the ceiling if I was tall enough. And we had all these catapulting success stories, and everyone thought it was I, and it was probably me more as an importer of concepts that were foreign to industries that pretty much followed the same herd approach, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And then it got to be after doing it, we did an analysis, and again, this is just clinical. I've done over 460 some industries, but we've done 7,100 in the last count, 24 sub-industries. And when you have that kind of a massive reference context and you've seen reality on the front lines of capitalism, I don't know, 1,000 different strategic approaches, you know, maybe 500 different marketing strategies, et cetera, all the way through business models, you have an advantage that an enormous number of people don't. And if you'll allow me, there's two other points that I think are very profound to everybody else.
Sure.
Actually, three. Four. I'll do it quick, though. In my evolution, I was blessed by having four things happen. One of my early clients was the Deming Organization. And you may be too young, but Deming was the father of process improvement and optimization, which is getting highest and best use of time, effort, opportunity cost, capital, human capital, relational capital. He approached it in terms of throughput manufacturing, and nobody came to me for help with their methodology. They came for me to help elevate their stature, monetize it more ways, more places, but I had to learn it. When I learned optimization and I learned all the different performance enhancement or impact points in a process or in a revenue stream, it exploded my awareness of how much more was possible, again, from an effort, an outcome, an ad. Then I learned direct response marketing, which shows you how to test and improve every impact point of your communication, because you've got the possibility of improving the same communication, same ad, same same email, same booth space at a trade show up to 21 times. And then it gets better. I worked with the world's largest multivariable testing organization, and I helped them with just marketing and positioning. But I got to look at $1 billion worth of very sophisticated $1 million-plus experiments they'd done on everything from placing, you know, different SKUs, you understand that, from the grocery business on shelves to different ways of articulating a sales proposition, different ways of following up after a sale for perseverance and to eliminate breakage. And then I got to work with the world's preeminent litigation strategic consulting firm and got to look at billions of dollars worth of case study research on venues, on how to depict pain and suffering or minimize it. And then lastly, I helped about 300 experts, and they came to me not for help with their methodology, but for help to position, elevate, re-monetize. But I had to learn a short course on all their methodology. So I was very blessed, not counting the commercial industries I've been in, but I got this outrageous composite and diverse, very expert education that is very unique. I don't know if that helps you, but that's how I explain it.
But Jay, you built that up, meaning over time you built that up, and eventually you had the right relationships, you had the right experience, people trusted you. But right at the beginning, like, how did you charge for something you didn't have? Meaning, how did you go in there the first time you took on a client?
Well, you have to understand how it began. So I had a succession of sort of jobs, and I was very fortunate because the last one I had was Entrepreneur Magazine. I was in charge of all the strategic marketing, and we grew it about, it was 800 or 900% in 1 year through a very powerful concept. And I stopped doing it, but at that point, I had a track record that was almost mythical, and I'm just saying it clinically. So I had a history of multiple outrageous, very short time period, you know, I guess I'd call them orders of magnitude growth. And it was not hard, because I was going to go back to challenge, not you, but when you said it's easy to sell consulting, you are right. It's easy to sell veneer consulting. It's very hard to produce results that are sustainable and meaningful. And I got very focused in my life from the beginning. Because I was, when you only eat if you earn, you learn what works and what doesn't and what works better. And I've always defaulted to result-based activities. So I was very confident. And then as we grew, we had, you know, it just became, like, there was a time when we had I think we had 1,000 testimonials in a book that weighed 8 pounds. And when people would say, why should I? Why should I trust you? We'd send it to him. We used to run, you don't know about my history. We did $250 million of seminars, and I just got a little too tired of doing being intellectual entertainment. But we used to run, this is pretty fascinating, we would run 20-page communiques in all the in-flight magazines and Success and Forbes. And what was unique about it is we would contribute probably 10 pages of actual methodology people could apply right away. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, we would have 3 pages of testimonials, but not the kind that most people have, which are generic and amorphous, and they would say J.A. California. We would have at least 20 different diverse people over the world, and we would have their daytime phone numbers you could call.
No way, really? That's incredible.
Well, yeah, because I made a difference in these people. People don't realize a testimonial is not just an affirmation of your contribution and your meaningful ability. It's an expression by the person or the company giving it that wants to help other people gain the same benefit or advantage. So these people were very eager. We just had a disclaimer that said, please don't call these unless it's the last, you know, the last mile in your finalization of your commitment, because don't bother them. But they were very delighted to talk, which was a great honor to me that they would be willing to do that.
Did you have a selection process as well? I'm assuming you didn't take on everybody.
Clients.
Yeah, in terms of clients and and mentees as well, by the way, as well.
Yes.
What was that selection process?
Well, it has evolved and morphed as I elevated the scope of interest and activities. But in the beginning, because the majority of my income, I didn't want, it sounds great to get $5,000 an hour, but it's even greater if you have the ability, if you can create enhanced performance for everything people are doing, and you can introduce higher performing alternatives and additions, plus new distribution channels, plus ancillary ways to repurpose buyers' distribution channels and get a percentage of that. So I always used my high price as a contrast to preferring to get a lower base fee and get a piece. So what I did was I always looked for companies in the beginning that had, I had a 12 or 15 point criteria. First of all, they had to be a company that added, again, I'm a fanatic about more value, more contribution, more preeminence, which is a longer discussion than probably today, to their market. Number two, they had to have a lot of what I'll call velocity, critical mass in motion, a lot of ads being run before the internet, a lot of online, a lot of leads coming in, a lot of salespeople in the field, a lot of trade shows they went to. So I had leverageable, a lot of, you know, if it was telephone selling, 100, 200, 300 salespeople, a large number of distributors or franchisees, they had to be meaningfully underutilizing whatever they were doing in a way I could easily see that there was a huge catalytic opportunity for me. They had to be collaborative and open.
Why do you think that they can't see what you can see? Meaning they're bringing you into a company that's, I'm assuming, you know, successful, right? Why? What?
Hopefully, yes.
Right, right. They're already pretty much right. So, what can you? And I'm not. You know, I'm asking this. I'd love to know, why is it that someone can come into a company and see something that none of them can see? And they're bright individuals, right? They've managed to grow the company so far. So, what is it that they can't see that you can?
It's an advantage disadvantage, and I'll tell you what it is. First is probably how my brain is wired, both in seeing correlations, implications, anomalies, patterns, distinctions that can be distilled down and universally reapplied. Number two, it's the depth of real world frontline of capitalism, highly diverse worldwide, not just here. I do it in Japan. I do it in China. We do $25,000 a person. I'm not being arrogant, mm-hmm. just are factual. 90-minute makeovers to entrepreneurs on a stage in Shanghai through translation where they get their money back if I don't succeed. So I've had to really perform, and I couldn't fake it. I've done, you know, I don't know, 20. Last year we were in Italy twice. We were in Paris. We were in London twice. We were in Ireland. I was in Vietnam. I was in Bangkok. I was in Tokyo. And I think I was in China. I don't remember. But I have to deal through translation, and you have to be able to communicate clearly. But the biggest point is I have a context of understanding that's almost, very truthfully, it sounds unreal. And the advantage is I can see something from a 360 CAT scan, kaleidoscopic, unimaginably diverse set of possibilities that are all empirical based. They're not theoretical.
Is there a way that somebody listening to this can adopt those skills, or is that something that you're just born with and you can't actually get?
I mean, I can't promise you'll be I was going to say the detriment is I'm so expansively involved in interest that I don't run my own business. So I have to be very, very good at what I do and earn a lot of money because I don't have that other kind of focus. But I would say that the biggest lesson that I learned that I try to teach everybody is what I call funnel vision versus tunnel vision. And Daniel, it's very simple. stretch yourself to learn not just what people are doing in your industry, but what people are doing everywhere else. Stretch yourself to learn and examine and observe and evaluate and acknowledge how other people see life, because it's very different than you in terms of their experiences, their definitions, their value correlations. Stretch yourself to see how other industries, markets, sell, relationship build, because that's where real growth comes from. If you look at, and I'm going to go back, but if you look at some of the greatest, and I'm going to go old because my brain is going to just go to deferred references that I've used a lot, but Federal Express was nothing more than adopting and adapting what used to be the way that the Federal Reserve Bank cleared checks. They just applied to hub and spoke to them. Telecommunications got almost all of its technology from aerospace. Viagra was originally, I can't remember if it was used for hearts, Rogaine for something else. Either the ballpoint pen or the roll-on deodorant was taken from the one or the other. And I can go on and on and on and on.
Interesting, right.
But breakthroughs, everyone's looking for internal breakthroughs. That's a lot of effort. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of speculative high risk. When you can adopt, integrate, synthesize, not just one, but multiple proven and very, very well validated approaches from outside your industry, you've got great advantages, like the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, Daniel.
Nope, you lost me on that one, Jay. Sorry.
Well, there's an adage that the one-eyed man in the land of the blind is king, because he's the only one that can see.
Oh, I get it. Okay, cool.
I'm sorry. I'm aiding myself with vintage phrases.
You're seeing what works in one area, and you're swiping deploying in another area. It's genius.
And I would say yes. I just personally don't like the word swipe, because it connotes to me. Again, I'm not knocking you, because swipe files are commonplace terminology. But I think you are borrowing and bettering. Borrowing and bettering.
I like that better. You're right. Borrowing and bettering. I like to
think in terms of that. But basically, you're adapting.
Yeah.
And you're importing and integrating all kinds of different strategic and operational. I mean, it's we were doing this, frankly, long before the concept of best practices. And best practices, I can go at a much, I mean, I'm not trying to be arrogant. I can show you how to take the concept of best practices to sublime, because there's ways to go so much deeper and more granular. But again, it's not because of me. I've been exposed to outrageous spectrum of much brighter thinkers, entrepreneurs.
So basically relationships is also a big factor, key factor in how you manage to get to where you are, right?
I think relational capital is the most undervalued, underappreciated, and underutilized element.
What would you say are the most important relationships you've built to get to where you are today?
That's interesting. I was very blessed because I helped Tony Robbins earlier in his career, and I think I'm the only person that he does a full day with in problem-solving clinics for his people. And he still extols my attributes 30 years later. He's been a very I have a couple of people who are very well connected, who I have purposely added a lot of value to, and they've connected me a lot. Stephen M. R. Covey was not he never connected me, but he was a wonderful. Wonderful advocate. I'm trying to think because I'm very unique, because I've had such a blessed life and so many interesting people be benefactors and contributors to my relationships. I think it, rather than identifying a person, I would configure the question and say, what's the greatest lesson that you've learned? And it's a little trite, but you got to find a way to first show somebody your relevancy. And I'll give you a couple of examples. When I started out, and there still is a company, but it was a huge company back in the days of audio, Nightingale Conant, and they had every major business icon that they published audio, and I wanted all those people to endorse me, and I went to Nightingale, and I, by the way, we're going to send you another book that's an old one, but we have a book called Money Making Secrets, Mr. X. We sold about 70,000 copies of before the first one at about $400, and this was a great book. And I asked if I helped Nightingale first, and we made them a lot of money. And then I asked them if they would go to all their authors and their experts in the business community and ask them if I could buy them 2 hours of my time and also give them my book. And if they, and there was no other expectation, if they wanted at the end, they would be certainly welcomed and appreciated if they wanted to give me any kind of an encouragement or have me do anything else for them gratis. And he got me 100, and I spent 2 months not making a cent, but consulting with prominent people all over the world. And I got 80 of them to end up endorsing me because my contribution, my ideas, my relevancy was clearly conveyed. But I think you have to have the right, most people try to build relationships for themselves, and that really doesn't get you the outcome you want. I think that I've been blessed because I've been able, first of all, to add really meaningful and quite uniquely explosive value to people. And I'm not being arrogant. I'm just giving you a truthful assessment. Mm-hmm. And I ask nothing in, I mean, like, as I told you this, we made a decision 5 years ago that we wanted to be the greatest entrepreneurial benefactor in the world. So we gift to people better resources, and we don't ask for an opt-in because I know it'll still help my brand currency. I know that most people can't afford me, but I can afford to invest in them, and it always comes back. But you have to have you also have to be able to think not selfishly, but selflessly. And selfless is probably, frankly, the most selfish because it pays off out of proportion to short-term, you know, self-interest. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that I could say, but I think that relationship building has to be predicated on two things. You have to be interested first in someone to be deemed interesting, and you have to really be connected to have them connect you. And I think it's more than most people. It's actually simpler, but it requires a purity and a highly concentrated commitment to the relationship. And I don't think most people have the ability or the understanding of how outsized the return will be, both in financial yield and in psychological, emotional. I mean, I've got a great friend who's the former senior advisor to the third largest private equity firm that became a dear friend because someone said we ought to be friends. He introduced me, and now I'm a senior advisor to one of the most prestigious young entrepreneur technology mentoring firms. Somebody else introduced me to one of the biggest hedge fund guys, and my wife and I get invited every year to the biggest hedge fund conference. And you got to be able to really be interested and you got to understand what value means to other people. And Daniel, most people don't care.
What
and
do
that's
people
why
value?
People are frustrated and don't get what they want because they don't understand what to give, if that makes sense.
What should they give? What do people like? The people listening to this now, what advice could you give them to start building key relationships? What should they be giving? What do people see as valuable?
I don't do anything free. Because I think free is so discounted. I will buy you a $1,000 program, or I will buy you something that's not on the market. And I want to establish, I think, first of all, you have to establish value. Mm-hmm. And there's two kinds of value. There's the value that the other side defines, and it may not be the same criteria as yours. And then there's valuing yourself and not being arrogant. And that's very delicate. That requires you to appreciate what you bring to the table but to understate it, but make sure that that value is expressed as long as, and here's where the nuance comes in, it's congruent with the value definition of the other side. I don't believe in, and yeah. one of the things that I'm very adamant about, I don't believe at all in one size fits all. Mm-hmm. When I counsel a client about giving something in a web in a, on a website, mm-hmm. I make certain that first of all, they never give. Second of all, that they always invest and purchase it for the other side, and that they yeah. always establish three things. A implied or explicit agreement of what they want the other side to do and why they are investing in them. In other words, I'm not just giving you a free report. I'm investing this educational primer in you because I think you'll take it, you'll sit down, you'll spend the quality time and attention to really thoroughly study it, you'll evaluate it in your mind, you'll apply it in your business or in your life, you'll see evidential results. Those results will be meaningful. It'll validate my value to you. You'll then want to come back and invest some of the benefits you got from me mm-hmm. investing in you back into something commercial. And I established right. that, but I think that it's a longer conversation.
It's amazing how little people actually ask people, what do you actually want?
And I think I would agree. I have to ponder a little bit that I don't think, I'll tell you, I have a little different take, but it's probably coming to the same destiny or the same destination, excuse me. I don't think many people really are clear on what they want and why they want it. And I believe very sincerely, Daniel, that if you're able to put in words for them what they want and what they don't want, and they've never crystallized that, you have an incredible connection with them. And that's been my experience, is to study and think through very carefully and try to understand what they really want. And I'll give you a simple example, and it was in a book you didn't read, but we used to laughingly say, if somebody goes to Home Depot to buy a drill, do they really want a drill? Not really. They want a hole. Or they yeah. want to attach something. And people don't realize what they really want. And the people that are able, and not manipulative, but deeply reflective in behalf of the other side on what they really want and why, and can express that to them in a way that has never been verbalized or crystallized, have incredible power and connectivity. So just a throwaway idea.
Now, Jay, if I said that you had a 20 seconds now to speak to the world, literally the whole world. So if the whole world was listening to this and whatever you said, it would be translated to all the languages and everybody would understand what you're saying. And you had 20 seconds. What would your message be to everyone?
I think it's, you know, if I say I think, I probably burned already half the 20 seconds. But it's take the time to understand, appreciate, and respect everyone else.
Beautifully said. Jay, what's the best way for my listeners to get in touch with you?
If they want to, they can go to abraham.com. And the best thing I would say, it's not going to get in touch with me, but they can go to abraham.com/50shades and they can get an education of a lifetime without even having to give an opt-in. If they want to keep getting more cool things, they can opt in. But we're more contributing. I mean, we like making money, but we like adding value and helping entrepreneurs of all sizes, shapes, and kinds and places not just grow and prosper, but grow and prosper by creating more value for the other side. So, yeah, sure.
You've been absolutely incredible. This has been really, really inspiring. Jay, thank you so much for letting me pick your brain. Thank you to all my fellow brain pickers. I'm looking forward to the day when I'll be picking your brain.